At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Nine people and the fate of the American healthcare industry. Yeah, I'd say there's a business angle to that. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryznov. Thursday, June the 25th. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. 6-3 was the vote. As you know, the Supreme Court has struck down the latest challenge to the Affordable Care Act. And as much as that ruling will mean for people who now get to keep the government subsidies that are going to help them pay for health insurance, it means a whole lot, too, for insurance companies and healthcare providers. That is, the businesses that are still very much in the process of figuring out how to thrive in a still new healthcare environment. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY, Dan Gorenstein starts us off.
Hospital stocks jumped 8-15% as today's ruling came down. Jason McGorman, a healthcare analyst with Bloomberg Intelligence, says you never see that happen. Well, almost never.
I would say the last time I've seen over 10% move for hospitals was back in 2012 when the Supreme Court last had the Affordable Care Act.
It shows how this industry, one of the country's largest, is all in on Obamacare. Drug makers, device manufacturers, doctors, and nurses have spent the past several years learning the ropes in this new era where they get paid based on better health, says PricewaterhouseCoopers CC Connolly.
I know it's become a cliche. We're moving from volume to value, but it is the accurate shorthand.
As easy as that is to say, and trust me, lots of healthcare people say it all the time, few really know how to provide more value. Insurers are trying to figure out how to price new insurance policies. Hospitals are trying to figure out how to treat more patients outside the hospital. As these titans grope for answers, we're seeing mergers at historic levels.
It tells me that the industry is reorganizing itself.
Limor Daphne is a healthcare economist at Northwestern.
My concern is, are they reorganizing themselves in a way that is likely to benefit us, the consumer? Unfortunately, the evidence we have to date suggests that most consolidations are associated with higher prices.
Daphne says while more consolidation could hurt financially, she's optimistic this push towards value, as hazy as it is, will help us find a way to get more for our money, a path that we keep walking down thanks to today's court decision. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
A couple of blocks away from the Supreme Court at the Department of Education today, there were some higher ed news to be had. After a long wait and an earful from critics, the Obama administration has scaled back its plans to rate colleges on things like how much graduates earn and how much student debt they wind up piling on. From the Education Desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott has that story.
You could almost hear the collective sigh of relief on college campuses today. The original plan was not only to rate colleges on value, but to cut off federal dollars to those that didn't measure up. But that's not going to happen. Instead, education officials plan to put out a website later this summer and let consumers compare colleges on their own.
We think that the ultimate accountability is a kind of public accountability that's created by a marketplace of really good information.
That's Undersecretary of Education Ted Mitchell. He wouldn't say exactly what information the new consumer tool will provide. And a lot of info on costs and graduation rates is already out there on the department's College Navigator website and a newer tool called the College Scorecard. Rachel Fishman has been studying how students make college decisions at the New America Foundation. In a recent survey she shared, just 16% of students said they'd ever used those websites.
There's no guarantee that the students that are most vulnerable in their decision making and who don't have enough good information to make that decision are actually going to find a website from the Department of Education useful.
Mitchell says the department plans to do outreach so students know about the new tool. It'll also share its data, whatever that turns out to be, so that others can experiment with how to present it. The federal government isn't exactly known for its user-friendly websites. Kim Clark writes about education for Money magazine, where she developed her own college value rankings. She's not sure how useful the data will be without some kind of ratings attached.
Most people don't think about this stuff all day like I do, and they don't know which numbers they should be looking at. So without expert guidance, all of these extra numbers might just be more noise and more confusion.
Then again, she says there's a whole industry out there that profits from giving that kind of guidance. And maybe with this new data, she says, college rankings will actually get better. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There was some interpretive jiggery-pokery on Wall Street today. We'll have the details. That was Justice Scalia in the SCOTUS ruling today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. While prosecutors and defense attorneys in Baltimore who were involved in the Freddie Gray case make their arguments in court, there are still the economic realities of that city that residents have to deal with. 20 years ago, the Clinton administration gave Baltimore $100 million in a pile of tax breaks to help create jobs in some of that city's poorest neighborhoods, neighborhoods that came to be called empowerment zones. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Noel King went to Baltimore to see how they turned out 20 years later.
As part of its job creation effort, Baltimore sunk millions of dollars, some federal money, some private, into an area called Fairfield. Jay Brody is the retired president of the Baltimore Development Corporation, the city's economic development agency.
This was an old industrial area dating back to World War II and even before then. There were Liberty ships made in World War II on piers in Fairfield.
Fairfield was a petrochemical hub when the empowerment zone started.
And the petrochemical life was changing. It was frankly going to Asia, which most of it has gone, Indonesia particularly. We thought we could get some clean new industries in.
So Baltimore spruced Fairfield up, starting in the mid-90s.
Some of the money went for infrastructure, empowerment zone money. Every time it rained in Fairfield, it flooded. And this made it a little hard to attract industries. So there was a substantial investment, $10 million, $15 million, in fixing the roads.
An infrastructure investment, and then a push to bring businesses here.
Hi.
Hello.
Are you Pete?
I am.
Noel, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Pete Sevison runs Petro Express, a fuel delivery company.
Oil, gasoline, and diesel fuel. You see a terminal at the end of the street. It comes either through barge or through the pipeline. It comes from refineries in Texas.
About 15 years ago, his dad got a small business loan to buy this Fairfield property. The loan was made possible by Empowerment Zone funds. The business is still here. He has 22 employees. Entry-level drivers start at about $15 an hour. Baltimore's minimum wage is $8. But then he tells me there's a reality about hiring in Baltimore, especially hiring in troubled neighborhoods. Last winter, Sevison couldn't find enough workers.
I couldn't get any qualified applicants for whatever reason.
For whatever reason.
They have to have a trucker's license. They have to have a TWIC card, which allows them to get into the terminals that are located near water. And, you know, they got to have a clean background.
They need a clean background because Petro Express delivers fuel primarily to government buildings.
We deliver Camp David, you know, anything government. And, you know, if they can't get into those locations, I can't employ them. That was most of the issue.
Case in point, the Sandtown Winchester neighborhood. It drew attention after the death of a young resident, Freddie Gray, in police custody. A study released this year by the Justice Policy Institute and the Prison Policy Initiative found Sandtown is also the most incarcerated neighborhood in Baltimore. Every year, Maryland spends $17 million to jail people from Sandtown and neighboring Harlem Park. Those neighborhoods have the greatest number of incarcerated people. A marketplace analysis found the unemployment rate in Sandtown is 22%. A criminal record can be a problem for people who want to work. Nancy Lavine directs the Urban Institute's Justice Policy Center. She has studied prisoner reentry in Baltimore.
In many jurisdictions, the formerly incarcerated are unable to hold positions as barbers, even though it's something that they've trained for behind bars, because as a barber or a beautician, you're wielding a sharp object. Landscaping jobs as well, because you have to handle poisonous substances.
Levine says she finds this puzzling, in part because as an expert on prison reentry,
on occasion, I get calls from employers who are looking to hire people with criminal records. In truth, they have found that people with criminal records are very motivated to make good. They really want the jobs.
But employers often keep quiet about that.
There's a dirty little secret out there that a lot of employers are already hiring people with records and knowingly doing so, and maybe even seeking them out. It's just that they don't see any benefit in advertising that.
But there are businesses that make it part of their mission to hire ex-inmates. GD Laminates in East Baltimore manufactures things like countertops and cabinets. The company was in the empowerment zone, so owner Greg Dively got tax credits for his employees through that program. He also got tax credits through a different program for hiring people who'd served time.
I've had better success hiring ex-cons than I did with people coming out of the neighborhood. They have to come to work every day. They love their job, and they appreciate what I do for them. At the same time, I appreciate what they do for me because they're helping me make money. They come to work every day, and they produce.
Dively portrays it as pure business pragmatism. A good worker is a good worker. He talks about one employee who's been with him a long time, a man named Kevin Parker, a former inmate.
Well, I would go to war with him, and he would go to war with me. Yeah, I made money with the guy. He's happy. He means something to me. Got a wife, got a kid, got a car, got a house. And he comes to work every day, does his job, and it's a partnership between me and him.
Over the years, Dively estimates he's trained about 200 men, both ex-inmates and young people from the neighborhood. Those he couldn't hire, he helped them find jobs elsewhere. Parker started here in 1999, 2 days after he got out of prison. He was jailed for involvement in a shooting. He was in his late 40s. He'd spent 23 years behind bars. Parker says Dively gave him a chance.
He was patient with me, proud of me learning, because he could have said, hey, you don't know that. But he didn't. He said, try it again.
And when he proved he could do the work, Dively gave him a future.
Every now and then I get a call, I'm going home. Kevin, I say, yeah. He said, you better look at your check. I said, for what? I'm saying, Dag, I know I got 40 hours. He said, no, I gave you a raise. I said, yeah. And, you know, he's a man to his word, and I respect that.
On my way out, Parker asked me to wait a minute. He wants to show me something.
This is the first dollar I made here in 99. I had it in my locker. When I cashed my check, I put a dollar in, and it's been there ever since. You see, it's weathered from chemicals and sawdust and all kind of stuff. It was a good start.
And the start was what he really needed. In Baltimore, I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
Coming up,
is Facebook a competitor or a partner? Is Snapchat a competitor or a partner? Both.
The guys who run Funnier Die. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 75 points today, about 0.4%, closed at 17,890. The NASDAQ shed 10 points, 0.2%, 5112. The S&P 500 off 6 points, 0.3%, 2102. Barry Diller's company, IAC Interactive Corporation, announced it's going to spin off its dating service business called Match Group for an IPO. That group includes, listen to this, Match.com, Chemistry.com, OkCupid, and Tinder, oh, by the by. IAC connected up 5% today. Some of the hospital shares that got snapped up after the Supreme Court ruling that Dan Gorenstein was talking about. Community health systems up nearly 13% today. Tenant healthcare up 12%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year treasury up to 2.41%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is a nonprofit, listener-supported service. To keep our coverage strong and relevant, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount counts twice thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from Newman's Own Foundation. Donate at marketplace.org by June 30th, and thanks.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. The University of Michigan issues its final June consumer sentiment survey. Your office may be a little more crowded when your coworkers observe "Take Your Dog to Work Day." And in other canine news, the world's ugliest dog contest takes place at the Sonoma Marin Fair in California. First place takes $1,500 and a trophy. I'm Michelle Philippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Denmark gets 40% of its power from wind, but it wants more. To do that, though, it's going to have to shake up the traditional relationship between electricity supply and demand. And as Stephanie Joyce reports, Danes are looking to a tiny island in the middle of the Baltic Sea for a little bit of guidance.
The grid control room at Østkraft on the Danish island of Bornholm is a mix of old and new. On one side of the room, huge computer monitors detail the flow of electricity throughout the system. On the other, printed circuit diagrams hang on 60s-era control boards with dancing needles. Jamming to early 90s dance music, engineer Eric Malmquist lounges at a desk, wearing a gray jumpsuit and thick eyeglasses. He's in charge of keeping the grid in balance.
You're here sitting at this desk all day. What do you do?
As little as possible.
As little as possible, and he's not joking. He explains that the utility profits when he does very little.
When I have to do anything, it costs us money, so I do as little as possible.
But doing as little as possible has gotten more difficult in recent years, as Bornholm has stepped up its share of renewable energy. It's much easier to balance a system that relies on coal than on fluctuating power sources like wind and solar. Momkus grabs a graph, printing out of one of the analog machines on the wall.
You can see here. You can see the wind, and then suddenly it goes up and down all the time.
Bornholm gets half its power from wind and solar. But of course, that power supply is intermittent and doesn't always match the times of day when people are using the most electricity. Momkus grabs another printout.
All days are look alike. We can see people get up in the morning about 5:30, and then they go to eat, and then they don't do it anymore.
Right now, when demand spikes and the wind isn't blowing, utilities like Østkraft ramp up production at their coal or gas plants. But Denmark is planning to be fossil fuel free in its power sector by 2030, which means soon that won't be an option. So instead of making supply meet demand, Østkraft is testing what it would take to make demand meet supply.
Demand response have nothing at all to do with energy savings. It has to do with using the energy when it's there.
That's Maya Benson. She also works for Østkraft, which is testing so-called demand response with roughly 2,000 households on Bornholm. Benson says she actually learned about the idea as a kid. Her family had a wind turbine, and when the wind was blowing hard,
we turned up all the radiator valves. Because it was windy, the wind turbine was spinning anyway. The energy was free and abundant.
The idea behind the project is the same. Use electricity when there's plenty of cheap, renewable power, and cut back when there isn't. It targets heating and cooling, which are the biggest electricity users. But unlike when Benson was a kid, the project automates it, so no one has to run around opening and closing radiator valves.
As a participant in the project, you say, which temperature do I want?
And the utility controls your heating to keep your house in that range. That allows the utility to temporarily shut off hundreds or thousands of heaters or air conditioners and keep the electricity grid in balance without having power plants on standby. Jürgen Christensen is the chief technology officer of Dansk Energi, the Danish Energy Association. He says it will be too costly to reach the country's renewable energy goals without demand response.
We are over-investing because we are not utilizing the energy that we produce in a smart way.
But even in Denmark, it's not easy to convince customers that there are benefits to allowing someone else to control their heating.
If it's totally new for you, you will say, well, let's wait and see what the neighbors does.
So if automating demand response is the cheapest option for making renewables work, can it happen elsewhere? In the United States, there are residential demand response projects, but none of them use automation, which limits the benefits to the overall grid. But start talking about controlling people's heating systems in a fiercely independent place like the U.S., and, well, you can imagine how that conversation would go. I'm Stephanie Joyce for Marketplace.
Stephanie's story came to us from the public media collaboration Inside Energy. Years ago, Will Ferrell of Saturday Night Live and the Anchorman movies, to name just a couple of ways you might know him, he and his buddy Adam McKay, the director of the aforementioned Anchorman franchise and a whole bunch of other films, started a company based on a relatively simple premise: funny or die. It's a video website where users would rate the videos, sometimes done in-house, sometimes featuring big-name actors and comedians. They would rate them as funny or die. The company is now a full-blown production house run by CEO Dick Glover and president of production Mike Farah. They're right over in Hollywood. So for this month's installment of Conversations from the Corner Office, the other day we went over for a chat and a quick office tour. And this being a comedy company, Dick Glover, of course, had to crack wise.
This is the floor. That's a ceiling. That's a wall. That's a giant.
I don't know if Glover and I have ever done a tour together. I don't know about our chemistry.
Hang on. It gets better.
I have to go see the horse.
All right. Most offices have a horse.
No, mine does not.
Really?
My office does not have a horse.
Oh.
We got Ms. Pac-Man and whatever that is.
A couple arcade classics.
Dick Glover, you're a conventional sort of content guy, right? You had long experience in this business. Well, it wasn't pejorative. ESPN and a bunch of other places. You had, Mark Farah, a completely different trajectory.
Yeah, I moved out here from Michigan 13 years ago as a grassroots thing. My first job was working security at movie premieres. And I guess I've just always, I still can't believe I get paid to work in Hollywood and do these things. People really support everyone's passion and their excitement. And it's like, it's all here for the taking. Like, the people that really succeed at Funny or Die are the people who come in, make the most of it for a year or two, and then leave. Now, as we mature, I think we're going to not let people leave so easily, because I think now our place is as good as any place.
Are you guys still a startup? Do you have a startup mentality?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Work hard, play hard, do well, and take the business very seriously. One of the characteristics of startups versus traditional companies is they are not risk-averse. And we're not afraid to fail. You know, we do tons of videos that people don't like. In fact, one of our selling points to the A-list talent is you might be unbelievably successful, do one movie that totally bombs, and suddenly start reading the stories about, you know, have you lost your mojo? With us, if you do it, it's some crazy idea, and it doesn't work, who cares? It's a, you know, cruddy little Funny or Die video. But if it works, it gets as much attention as any hit you've done. And so it's a great environment to take chances, which is almost the total antithesis of what you face in your day-to-day
life. We did this video with Dennis Quaid earlier this year.
Yeah.
That went very well.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
I had
this is the one where he's yelling at the kid off camera, yelling.
And I had nothing to do with it.
Which I thought was real for a minute or two.
Yeah, sure, a lot of people did. WME, his agency, called me. and said in all their years of representing, you know, any actor, they had never seen one piece of content change a conversation about an actor's career so quickly as that Dennis Quaid piece had.
I believe that. You guys move really fast. I mean, I've read stories about stuff going from an idea to on the web in like 3 days.
Or less.
Right. So how do you do that?
I love working with comedians. I love creative ideas, and I love getting things done really quickly. Now, it's been great because we've just grown organically to have that include branded entertainment, commercials, TV, live events. Speaking of DC, we just opened up an office in Washington, mm-hmm. DC that's kind of leveraging all the stuff that we've done in the political world. So I love hearing ideas that I know we and I can sell, and then putting people in a position to do that as well and as quickly as possible.
Does the business model work for you guys if you have a smattering of success on many levels and then one ginormous thing like Obama between two ferns?
No, it isn't predicated on those spikes of a piece of content at all. You know, again, we love having those and try, but what it really is a basic core business that we have an audience, whether it's through the social media, whether it's through the whole app strategy that we got, whether it's through the website, whether it's through television shows, and that, you know, adding up all of those bricks, you end up with a nice house.
But I would say the value of those huge viral videos is that it keeps us just top of mind.
Front and center.
Yeah, I mean,
that was the thing for a good number of days and weeks.
Yeah, and I do think we really believe that the right short comedic content, really any comedic content, can really change people's minds. It doesn't matter what industry you're in. Yeah. Hits are important. It's then leveraging those things and taking those hits and showing how we can do those things for lots of different groups.
Yeah. Who's your competition? And who are you sort of aligned with?
Clearly, the competition, we're in the entertainment space, and so you're just constantly trying to get people's time, of which they don't have much. We're in the social media space, so you're trying to get their attention there, again, of which people flit in and out and all of that. And we're in the basic kind of traditional media space, creating TV. So in every one of those, you could argue those people are all our competitors, but in the same token, they're all our partners in things. So is Facebook a competitor or a partner? Is Snapchat a competitor or a partner? Both.
Yeah.
Comedy Central, HBO, people who we do a lot of business with, but yet you could argue we compete with.
Dick Glover, Mike Farah, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Funny or Die CEO Dick Glover and president of production Mike Farah. They're standing in front of that horse you heard about up in the setup, by the way. You can see the tour and the horse as well in the video we took while we were out there. It's on our website and totally worth a look. We've also got the whole interview, all 28 minutes worth, in our new podcast, Corner Office, the extended version of our radio series of almost the same name. We've got a new one for you every month. It's all online at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, in which your smartphone is what you eat, in a certain figurative sense. CNBC had an item up this morning breaking out types of foods and fast food chains patronized by whether you're an iPhone user or an Android user. iPhone users, it turns out, are far more likely to order soup using their phones. Android users, meanwhile, are far more likely to order roast beef sandwiches. If big data is your thing, no matter how useful or useless you decide. We've got more of it on our website, marketplace.org. Oh my goodness, look at the time. Got to go. The Dow off 75 points today, about 0.4%. The S&P 500 off 6.3%. The NASDAQ down 10 points, 0.2%. Golda Arthur, Kate Concannon, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.